Part two. Okay. So now we're into disorders. So now, as I said last week, maybe you want to do that. Hey, nobody's wearing orange today. What's going on? Yeah, but for school today, because we're not here tomorrow. I have a golf tournament. I'm in a golf tournament tomorrow. I'm wearing orange tomorrow in a golf tournament. So, you like a shirt? Get bookstore if you want a really good. They do a different one every year. Do they?
Yeah.
So this is the one where I say maybe you should want to start doing those that grid, that whatever of, you know, name of disease, causes, signs, symptoms, so on and so forth, right? That may help. So atopic dermatitis, we actually talked about that last week, did we not?
Yeah.
Well, you and I did.
No,
yes. Correct. So the definition of atopic dermatitis is chronic or relapsing inflammatory skin disease characterized by pruritus, which is
itchiness.
Right. Okay. Now, as I said, this medical term is caused by a number of issues, of course, as we know, including dry skin disease, allergies, and diabetes. Atopic dermatitis is the most common type of eczema. Right. You may not know this as a form of eczema, but in fact, it actually is. Can be present during the first year of life. So 30% of children get it. It doesn't really say why in the book, but there are a number of causes for it, which can be genetic, immuno, or environmental factors. Number one being, this is why with babies, we want to use very mild washing chemicals, whether it's laundry soaps or, you know, hair shampoo or whatever. It's always very, very mild because the skin can react quite significantly. You can get a contact dermatitis by, you know, putting clothes on that have been washed by a very harsh detergent. Quite frequently it persists into adulthood. And basically, this atopy is a group of three associated disorders: asthma, allergic rhinitis, and this AD, which is atopic dermatitis. So it's atopy is a form of one of these allergic disorders. So it can be associated with asthma or allergic rhinitis, which of course is hay fever, so stuffy nose, you could get the rash and all that kind of stuff. Patients with atopic dermatitis often have a personal or family history of allergic disorders. So it's not unusual in terms of having a reaction. You probably suffer a lot from it and have most of your life because of your skin, and it's just something that can happen. The causes are multifaceted and include genetic, immunologic, and environmental factors. And, of course, family history and aberrant skin barrier gene coding are two risk factors. So some people, unfortunately, are born with their skin's not as protective as it should be, and so it tends to get irritated and you run into this much more often. It's unclear if inflammation exacerbates dysfunction or if a problem with the skin barrier causes immune dysregulation. So is it something that's rubbing on the skin that's causing it to occur, or is it something more that you have the skin barrier itself have these immune dysregulations where you're getting chronic inflammatory reaction just because there's a problem with the inflammation reaction with skin itself. Stress and emotional problems can worsen it, but not cause it. It is associated with sensitization to food allergens, so it can be as a result of certain sensitivities. Right now, does everybody understand what the difference is between a sensitivity and an allergy? What is? Well, you can develop an allergy. So what is the difference between, right, we've got in there, it says, we've got sensitization and allergy. So quite often, because you're going to say to patients, do you have any allergies? Oh, yes, I can't drink milk. But that's not an allergy. Lactose intolerance is not an allergy. So what is an allergy versus a sensitivity? So my daughter is allergic to milk because she's allergic to milk protein. So what does that mean to say she's allergic to milk versus me who can't drink milk because I'm lactose intolerant? Yes. Right. Right, so yeah, by an immune response, by having a full immune response towards that. Yes, like a celiac disease, what happens is they actually have an inflammatory reaction. Yeah, so their immune response in the gut to the fact that there's gluten in the gut. Well, you're not allergic to peanuts. You know you're not allergic. Nobody's allergic to peanuts. They're allergic to a fungus that grows on the peanut. Sensitivity is a sensitivity is a reaction that's inflammation. How do I say? Can you say inflammation without immunity? Kinda. So you're getting inflamed, so you get the rash and get a reaction to it. But you're not getting the full-blown white blood cells and all that kind of stuff reacting to it, trying to break it down and beat it, just as though you had, you know, a wound or something, or an invader like a virus or whatever, right? So, a sensitivity is not an allergy. That you'd have to be tested for that to know the difference. No, I once went to an in-service at the hospital. And they were talking about the precursors to being allergic to substances such as peanuts. And it's the peanut directly they're not allergic to. It's this mold that's in around peanuts that lives with under the shell that people have allergens to. Yes. Yeah, and you get a bigger histamine response and all that kind of stuff, yes. Right. And you don't get that histamine response thing. Right. But the reason I brought that up is because quite often in clinical settings, when your patient doesn't know any different, you say, "Do you have any allergies?" They'll say yes. And then you got to delve in to see what it is. So if they say something like, "Well, I can't drink milk," well, it's not really an allergen. It's actually an intolerance, right, which is a sensitivity. And it's due to the fact that you're missing lactase in your gut. You could, so but you have to have it tested for that. So what got my daughter into being looked at to see that she was allergic to milk proteins was she would get up every morning, have a bowl of cereal, and blow an entire box of Kleenex of snot out of her nose. Not kidding. It would just start pouring out of her, and she had to have allergy tests, and they discovered she's allergic to milk protein. So she can't have any dairy, really. At the end of the day, she can't have lactose-free milk or anything like that. She's everything's, you know, silk milk or almond milks or soy milks or whatever as far as that goes. So she can have those, but she can't have anything related to dairy. What's that? Ah! Silk next. Best it's going. Silk next. Looks like a cow. It's all black dots, like a cow skin on it. Yes, all to mix together. It is by far the best non-dairy milk that has ever been made. I use it. I bake with it. I have it in cereal. I do everything with it. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't over and there's no overpowering flavor. That's the problem with a lot of the other ones. You get It is. It's the best. It's got oat in it as well. Avoidance diet is recommended solely by allergy testing. So you know that's the reason why I said about allergy and sensitivity. You're starting to see this chronic atopic dermatitis, and it's been presupposed or tested that they're allergic to a particular type of food or something, then, of course, refraining from having those things that cause the allergic response is important. Eczerosis is usually worse during periods of low humidity, so it tends to get more irritated when there's low humidity. Anybody here? You have it a little bit. Does your eczema get really bad in the wintertime when the furnace is on and all that sort of thing, right, as compared to the summer when the humidity's higher? Yes, right. It's like that, you know, exoderma, you know, the roughened skin and all that sort of thing, the scaliness and all those sorts of things. The skin is a reduced water binding capacity, a higher trans epidermal water loss, and a decreased water content. So what happens in this condition, the skin is actually dehydrated, terribly dehydrated, which causes the problem of the roughness and the scaling and all those sorts of things. How does it manifest? Usually it begins during infancy in the form of red, oozing, crusting rash that typically appears as a diaper rash, okay? So we can, I don't have any diaper rash here, but you get a sense of, you know, I'm sure, well, no, this, you're all pretty young, you haven't had kids yet, but if you did, if you've seen diaper rash before, if it gets bad, it's, so that is very similar to what diaper rash can look like. It can get quite inflamed, and I have the cure for diaper rash, and it's completely anecdotal. My daughter used it and with two boys and never, ever had diaper rash, and that was coconut oil. She would clean them after they'd gone to the bathroom, change their diaper, and rub that area with coconut oil, and never had diaper rash, ever. Yeah. Yeah, never had it. I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, it's pretty good. As the child grows, that the chronic form results in skin that is dry, thickened, and brownish gray in color. Older still, the rash becomes localized in the large folds of extremities, so found mainly on the flexor surfaces, anterior neck, sides of the face, eyelids, and dorsal surface of the hands and feet. Sound familiar to some? Are you relaxing or is your hand up? Oh, you're relaxing? Okay. That's okay. You can keep it there. Viral bacterial such as Staphylococcus aureus and fungal infections may cause further skin changes. So what happens is, if you're going to have this kind of inflammation in the skin and this chronic dryness, what do you think the integrity of the skin's like in terms of being a barrier? Not so good. Right, it's not as good a barrier. So Staphylococcus aureus is actually a symbiotic bacteria that lives on all your skin. You all have Staph aureus on your skin. Staphylococcus aureus. Do you know what a staphylococcus is? Do you know what a coccus is? They're round, right? They're little round beads. So coccus means, well, they're elongated, but think of them as they're little oysters, one bead on top of the other, like little circles. Sure. Or this. Right? Little beads. No, it's a bacteria there's Streptococcus or Staphylococcus, but if you say coccus, it's like these little beads is what thing. So Staph aureus actually lives on your skin. The thing is, you need to have it there. It actually helps prevent other things from getting under your skin, but at the same time, it's a nasty bacteria because if it gets into your system, have you guys heard of necrotizing fasciitis? That's caused by Staph aureus. Flesh eating disease? Yeah, so what happens is the skin integrity gets broken and Staph aureus gets in and away it goes. Aureus? Yeah. If you have chronic inflammation like this, it can cause opportunistic infections from some of these things because the barrier of the skin isn't appropriate anymore and things can get in. So the example I use is if you have someone who's got a burn, like a really bad burn, the number one concern after a burn is infection because any floating bacterium or virus, there's no barrier, so it gets into the broken down tissues. It can cause massive infections. Sorry? Oh, no, fungus can get in as well. So what we're saying here is that because the skin gets broken down, viruses, bacteria, and fungus can actually have an opportunity to get in under the skin and cause massive infections. No, you can have fungal infections, but if the skin is completely intact and healthy, the fungus would have a very difficult time to cause an infection. Okay. Right. Do you know what one it was? Did they give it a name? So it could have been, you might have had initially atopic dermatitis, because you got to think of what's it like down here. It's moist and warm, right? And some of these things, that's the environment that they really flourish in. Right. Probably, I'll bet you it was just Lamisil. Is that hydrocortisone? Lamisil. Oh, okay. It didn't have curled edges, did it? Did it have curled around edges? That sounds like impetigo. Was it impetigo? Are you thinking impetigo? Yeah. Yes. How it shows. So that's how it shows. So how it manifests, how it, so clinical manifestation could be a rash, could be a fever, it could be a growth, it could be bleeding. Yeah, yeah. Manifestation is actually a sign. Can be a sign. Yeah. So a staph aureus infection can result in extensive crusting, serious weeping, folliculitis, which is the inflammation of hair follicles, pyoderma, pus, and boils, which are furunculoses. Boils are something we don't see much of anymore. Really? Not like we used to. Anybody here ever seen a boil? They're terrible, aren't they? Did you have them drained? Yeah, they're... Yeah, they're very pustulent. They can get very inflamed, lots of pus in them. They don't smell nice either. Yeah, they're awful. How do we manage it? Well, obviously, we want to break this inflammatory cycle because the inflammation is what's causing the skin to break down and further making it easier for it to continue. So topicals and systemic medications can be helpful. So they sometimes have to use antibiotics, you know, you have a significant infection. Antihistamines, so you're trying to lower the immune response, right? No different than you take an antihistamine if you have hay fever, that type of thing. You're really affecting mast cells with and histamine is what you're doing. Antimicrobials for microbes, you know, antifungals as well, corticosteroids, immunosuppressants if it's bad enough. If you have this chronic inflammation, sometimes you have to throw an immunosuppressant in there to break the cycle of inflammation and then take them off again. And then non-steroidals. Sometimes UV radiation is used. And I have heard from patients who have this in the summertime, it usually really, really comes down by just being outside in the sun over the summer and just, you can't sit there and bake, that's not good for you either, but just having UV rays on the skin. So sometimes dermatologists will have the patient actually get a UV lamp at home and spend time lying in bed with UV lamp over top of them, and it tends to really, really diminish the symptomology. Controlling or minimizing triggers in skincare is the focus. So how is your personal hygiene? What changes do we need to make? Daily moisturizing, and of course, any irritants. So, you know, such as changing your soaps, like your laundry soap, or changing your hair shampoo, or whatever. I mean, I don't know what yours is like, but I've known many women who, you know, places like Sephora or, you know, these high end places, you know, that have all these great things that ladies like to put on or all over their bodies. They can't touch them because their skin just blows up and they can't deal with it. In fact, my last relationship, she had something, and it was a mosquito bite, and I talked her into just taking a little bit of Q-tip on the tea tree oil, and it was like I might as well have put battery acid on. She just, it burned the skin. She had this massive inflammatory response to it. So you probably can't use anything that's too smelly either. Like if it's got lots of fragrance in it, it's probably just irritating as can be, right? Oh, yeah. Yeah. And dietary recommendations should be done through allergy testing, which is something that's not done overly too often anymore either. You don't hear kids going for allergy testing all the time. And in my age, used to be all the time. Well, then be careful.
Yeah. But they didn't even test me for that.
Oh, interesting. So you can see here, you can see the inflammation, You can see this dry scaling that's occurring here, right? It shows up a little bit more in the darker skin. We have these white dry scales that will fall off, and then to the point where you start. You can see here where the epidermis is actually broken down, and you can see the dermis underneath, and that's why you can say that opportunistic and bacteria and so forth can get into that sort of exposed area and get down into the deeper tissues and cause pretty big infections, that kind of stuff. No? So that is atopic dermatitis. Now there's contact dermatitis. Can be the acute or chronic skin inflammation caused by exposure to an external agent that can act as an allergen or irritant. Could be chemical, mechanical, physical, or biologic. So here's the other thing you need to do to study this stuff. What is the difference between atopic dermatitis and contact dermatitis? Right off the top. You can? Okay, something even simpler than that. Right? Did you see an age there? Because you go back here, what did it say? Begins during infancy and as the child grows. Here, could be at any time. You don't start to have this as a genetic or whatever condition as a young person. So this, you may spend your entire life having normal skin, and then one day someone talks you into buying this brand new laundry soap, and you use it, and you put your shirt on, and by the end of the day, you're like inflamed, or, you know, I've used this one before, right? You can see here, this, any idea what might cause this? Eye cream or makeup, right? So they tried something new, and it's an irritant, and all of a sudden you have inflammation from your rings. Yeah, that aren't gold, right? That aren't real. You can say aren't real, correct? Yeah, because you're having a reaction to whatever metal is in there, and it's all it is that it just doesn't like it. So those are the things that you need to start looking at when you're starting to compare one disease to another. What age does it affect? When does it start? Is it more male than female? Is it very young? Is it older in age? That's what you have to start sort of pulling out. Sorry? Well, it says, so if you look at a topic here, commonly. But it also, so when it says commonly begins during infancy, usually, like if you know anybody, like you started early,
yeah.
Right? And if you know anybody who's got, you know, significant eczema, or you see, you know, they've got it on their hands and elbows and so forth, if you talk to them, they've been battling that most of their life, right? Whereas atopic, or whereas contact dermatitis, you could go all the way to your 45 years old and then use one thing, wrong cream or whatever, you've got this huge inflammatory reaction. So the causes can be chemical, mechanical, physical, or biologic. Fragrance, common items such as silicone cell phone covers, medical devices such as an insulin pump. Right? These, any of these things that are. Did you react to your insulin pump?
Yeah.
Probably because of silicone. Have you been checked for silicone? You really should. It's one of those things. If you think you have the potential for silicone allergy, you really should get checked because you could be unconscious in a hospital, and it's in everything. Silicone is in everything in the hospital. Oh my God. IV bags, IV tubes. It's in gloves. It's in everything. Didn't have too bad. Okay. That's good. So you should be checked. It is one of the most common environmental skin diseases that can occur at any age. And that's the key thing. Environmental. If you look at the last atopic we talked about, that was more internal, right? It was more, it could be genetic, could be an inflammatory, whatever. This is something that's environmental. So something in the environment is causing this to happen. A cream, a lotion, a material that you're wearing, of you know, whatever your shirt or whatever is made of. Common allergies include nickel, which is probably what's in your rings, because it's dirt cheap to make stuff out of nickel. Wool fats. So anybody here allergic to or get really irritated with wool? Like pure wool sweaters? Yeah? Okay. Rubber additives. Topical antibiotics. Interesting, eh? That you have to be very careful with this, because if you've got a skin condition of inflammation, the doctor's going to give you a topical for it, and you might be allergic to it to make it worse. Topical anesthetics. We don't see benzocaine and lidocaine much in Canada. It's very, very common in the U.S. to have benzocaine and lidocaine creams, and that just what it does is numb. So it does, it just numbs to take the issue away. Corticosteroids, which are normally used to treat the condition that can cause it, and silicone sensitivity. And if you go in the hospital, it's usually a question you always get asked. Do you know whether or not you're allergic to silicone? Right? That's silicone. That's silicone. Yep, that is too. Yep. It's everywhere. It's a compound that's used in freaking everything now. Right? That probably is too, right? It's really rubbery. Yeah. Probably something in there too. I think it's one of those common things you don't even know is there. How does it manifest? Intense pruritus, which is itching, right. Erythema and edema of the skin can occur 1 to 2 days post-exposure, especially if you've had it before. They can begin at the site of exposure, but it can extend to distant sites as it spreads out. You get this sort of reaction of inflammation. It can progress to fasciculation, oozing, crusting, and scaling. So it can get bad enough that you start seeing skin break down and getting these things happening. If you end up with long-term symptoms of these sorts of things, what happens is the skin starts to thicken in reaction to the chronicity of it, and then you start to see pigment changes. So it'll actually get darker, or usually darker, but in darker skin people, I believe it gets lighter. I do believe that. Okay. Medical management. They usually resolve within 3 weeks. Chronic lesions can persist until the cause of aging is removed. Obviously, a good history is important because, you'll say if they got the rash, first thing out of my mouth is use any new creams, lotions, makeup, shower, soaps, hair, shampoo, whatever, seeing if there's something that's just altered just a bit. And if required, primary treatment is removal of that agent, and treatment of the skin is secondary. Getting rid of the agent is far more important than treating the stream. You've got to get rid of what you think is causing it. If required, treatments are similar to the atopic dermatitis. So we can see here, it can get pretty extensive depending on what's going on, from mild here to fairly significant. You know, that could be just as simple as someone tried a new hand cream.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
that's possible. This is common nickel, and he said that's you, right? On the finger with the ring?
Yeah.
So eczema and dermatitis. The two terms are interchangeable. So eczema is a form of dermatitis. Dermatitis would mean inflammation of the... Right. Okay. Basically, these two, they describe a group of disorders with a characteristic appearance. It is a superficial, itchy inflammation of the skin. It's usually caused by an irritant that you're exposed to, an allergic sensitization or delayed hypersensitivity, allergic or atopic dermatitis, or genetic determined idiopathic factors. I will repeat. You can have a delayed hypersensitivity, which is either an allergic reaction or atopic dermatitis, or it can be a genetically determined idiopathic factor. What's idiopathic? Don't know. It's just there. Don't know why. Okay? It's one of the most frustrating things to tell. Yeah, don't know where it came from. It's very difficult to tell patients that, sorry, I don't know where it came from. They don't like it. They always want to know where it came from. So you do have a couple of different types of these. One is called seborrheic. Seborrheic dermatitis is dandruff. Okay. You can have nummular, which is a discoid type. Is that what you were thinking about when you were talking to about the round circles in the skin with Caitlin? A type of nummular, like a discoid type of dermatitis? Yeah. Your rashes are all circles. It's like little discs all over your body, right? And then, of course, the last one is stasis dermatitis or venous eczema, which is like poor circulation, skin breakdown right in a particular area that we see. We can see here, this is eczema that we can see here. This is the discoid type here. Here we have stasis dermatitis. So this individual here has very poor circulation down to the foot, and the skin is breaking down into this type. And then the seborrheic type we can see here under the beard. The skin's breaking down because very poor venous circulation. Eventually, and if it gets bad enough, they chop it off. Yep. very common in the elderly. The older you get, the more the more peripheral, especially in the legs, the more your peripheral circulation gets poorer, especially if you've got a comorbidity like diabetes. They get neuropathies, and then they get poor circulation, and it usually starts with, like, they're clipping their nails, and they nick the skin, and they get an infection, and they can't get rid of the infection, and the toe gets amputated, and then it just starts cutting back. Yep. Yep. Unless you really manage your sugars well, and then it's so much better. That's what's so important to get through to diabetics is manage those sugars. Don't go crazy with your sugars because it doesn't do well. Yeah, good. They can't yet, no. 40% of people with eczema have other atopic conditions such as food hypersensitivities, allergic rhinitis, and asthma. It's almost like they have like chronic hyper-inflammatory reactions to everything. So these kind of folks that, me, should we put your picture on here when I teach it? Right, but it just happens to go along with it. It is characterized by periods of exacerbation and remission. Everybody knows what exacerbation means, right? So it's either flared up exacerbation or in remission, no symptoms whatsoever. There are three primary stages, acute, subacute, and chronic. They can manifest separately, but they can also coexist at the same time. So acute, you will suddenly have extensive erosions with serious exudate. What's exudate? Serious exudate, not serious, sorry. Serious exudate, what's that? Serious exudate, here in acute dermatitis. So extensive erosions with serous exudate. Yeah, they're wet. The skin breaks down and you start to see serous fluid starting to come up through. No, it actually leaks. They're actually wet. Yeah. No, the skin's broken down. The serous fluid underneath is starting to kind of pour out of the skin's not whole holding together anymore. It gets these erosions where the skin kind of has these minor separations, the erosions, and the exudate kind of leaks out. Yeah, you can see it. Like you can see there's scabs on it here, but at what point these would have been really wet and leaking? Yes. Okay. Or intensely pruritic erythematous papules and vesicles. So you get itchy, red, raised papules, and fluid-filled vesicles, but no pus, right? There's no pustule there. So this is why I give you the definitions in the first place, because the terminology, again, you know, you learned terminology in first semester medically for, like, anatomy. Now for pathology, you have to start learning new terminology. So when you read this, extensive erosions with serous exudate or intensely pruritic erythematous papules and vesicles. So it's telling you that breaking down the skin with fluid leaking, very itchy, redness, raised papules, and wet vesicles. And you can kind of see it here, right? You've got all these raised areas here. Okay. And you can see how wet this one is. This discoid one here looks a bit shiny and wet. Erosion's broken down. You see how the skin's all broken down here? See how there's scabs underneath? And you can see the skin is actually broken apart and broken down here. Subacute dermatitis is characterized by the same thing, the redness. Excoriated skin, so it's been scratched and abraded, so it's breaking down the skin that way. Scaling papules or plaques grouped or scattered over this reddish skin. So if you know anybody who has eczema, you'll see they actually have they can flake these little scales off. These dry scales can come off. And you pick at them, don't you? Yes. Because they're there. I mean, they're itchy. That's the itch in the first place, and then they just kind of come off. And yes. Yes. Chronic is characterized by thickened skin with increased skin marking. It's called lichenification, secondary to rubbing and scratching. You get excoriated papules, fibrotic papules, and nodules. Prurigo nodularis and post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation and hypopigmentation. What does that line mean?
Hypopigmentation.
What's that mean?
Hypo means, yes.
Okay, yeah, with hyper. Dark pink darkening or redness. And what is, use the term here, what is excoriated papules? It's the race, the pimple without pus. What do you mean by excoriated? Yeah, and actually broken the tops off. Scratched so much that they're broken apart. No, it's like a mosquito bite, you scratch the point that you scratch the whole top off. But because these are dry, they get crunchy and hard. The patient scratches it and it breaks the hard tops off. You're just lucky. You're scratching that hard. You're just fortunate enough that you're not making it bleed, because most people, if you scratch that hard, you'd probably break the skin down and be bleeding. So get to know these terms, and maybe when you're doing the studying, you write down the definition as you're going through, so you know exactly what it's saying, right? It's a whole different language. That's why I give all the definitions at the beginning of every section, the key terms, because it goes, they show up. I have sat and listened to two pathologists talk to each other, and it's like, what? Because it's an entirely different language that they speak. It's very different. So you can see them here. So you can see, so when we go back to the stasis dermatitis here in the picture, can you see how much darker the condition is as compared to the surrounding skin? Right? It's really hyperpigmentated. It's really gotten dark and thick, because this tells me that this has been going on for quite some time. This has been a very long ongoing inflammatory condition, and the skin has reacted by thickening and darkening as a result of that. Not really. What's that? Oh, well, I'm fair enough. I understand that. You know what? The only thing you can do, okay, is just do what you're supposed to do, be good at it, be the best you can be in terms of maintaining your sugars and whatever, and after that, whatever it is, it is. And this is gonna sound really bad of me. But I'll tell you this, and it's gonna sound kind of cruel and cold, and I don't mean it that way. 100 years ago, you'd be dead. No, 150 years ago. You wouldn't have lived this long because we didn't have insulin. So thankfully you have it. And my understanding is every year we get closer to actually curing diabetes than just managing it. Thing, yeah. So, you never know. You might find yourself one day you'll get a pancreas transplant or something they'll be doing, and boom, it'll be gone. You won't have to worry about it. No. Right. Oh, interesting. Oh. Now, do you think the immune system sees the hormone as not appropriate? Yeah, because the insulin might be looked at the body by, you're not my insulin. Okay. Interesting. So the other thing you want to put in your chart is incidence and etiology. Yeah, so what's etiology? Anybody, what is etiology? Yes. Okay, so it is a common disorder in children and older adults. It can be caused by hypoproteinemia, venous insufficiency, allergens, irritants, or underlying malignancies. So certain leukemias and lymphomas can cause this to happen. But when we look here, hypoproteinemia, what would that be? Correct. Venous insufficiency. So you know, you have to remember what way is blood moving in the venous system? It's going away from the tissue. So venous insufficiency means you have this oxygenated blood going into the tissue and it can't get out. There isn't the ability to do it, to get it back. No, it just means you get congestion of arterial blood in the tissues that eventually starts breaking down the tissues. Varicose veins can lead a bit, if they're bad enough, to venous insufficiency. Yeah, because you can, when we get to the cardiac part, if you have, but you also get, it's not unusual with varicose veins in some cases to get significant inflammation and painfulness and swelling and all that sort of stuff around the sites because of this insufficient ability to be able to clear the blood out of the tissues and it gets stuck in there. Okay. Right, it's having a hard time getting out of the limb. So we go back to this picture here. The blood's coming down the leg nicely, but then it's getting stuck here because it can't get back. So you get all this change happening. Okay. Adult or adults taking multiple medications, which can also result in dermatitis from drug interaction. This is why, you know, it's nice in Ontario. In most cases, if you have a medication, you have a good chart at the pharmacy office. They look at what you're currently on and see if there's any interactions because sometimes physicians, don't forget that you might be on a different medication. And some medications can cause terrible side effects if they're mixed together in terms of situations. And of course, aging skin can result in flattened epidermal dermal junctions, thinning of the dermis, which results in skin fragility. And of course, that skin fragility results into further possible dermatitis and also the tearing and breaking down of skin, which can lead to infections and so on and so forth. Stasis dermatitis. Basically, this is a development of red, itchy plaques that may open to form shallow ulcers in the lower legs. So you can see them here. So you've got these pustulant ulcerations here. You can see the skin is breaking down all around it and getting to a point where you've got this dry scaling kind of situation happening. So this is, again, from underlying venous hypertension and resultant venous insufficiency. So what's happening here is the skin is becoming so congested with blood because blood can't get out, it actually gets an inflammatory response and breaks down to the point where they may have to amputate the leg because it just breaks down. So, what's that? Do you know how common this is? Especially in diabetics. Correct. So you're getting blood congestion in the tissues, which breaks it down, and then. Yeah, so blood's coming in and can't get out. So it's hanging around and it just starts dying, I guess is the best way to put it. Yeah, you're going to long-term care and you're likely going to see this. You don't treat this. This would be, no. This would be a local contraindication. You wouldn't be in there massaging this by any means. It's likely in this individual, they probably have what's called a neuropathy as well. They probably don't feel it. Like quite often when you see this sort of thing, the patient doesn't seem to be in any agonizing pain. Most times by this point, even the nerves aren't working well. They can, but it's not anywhere near what's happening. Well, part of what happens with neuropathies is in diabetes with a neuropathy, the parasympathetic sympathetic reaction to vasodilation gets really poor and they just don't vasodilate and you can't get good movement. Increased venous pressure occurs when there's venous obstruction or damage to the valves and permit retrograde venous flow. The pressure then pushes the red blood cells, proteins, and other cells out into the interstitial spaces. So it actually pushes it out of the capillaries in between the cells and the tissue, which results in what's called extravascular inflammation that's occurring, increased tissue edema, and impaired tissue diffusion rates. And then what happens is the metabolic requirements of the cells in the skin, they don't get what they need, and they start dying. What's pus? Do you remember what pus is? What causes pus? Yes. Right. So when you have pus, that there's been an inflammatory response here, you've got macrophages here trying to eat up the necrotizing cells here in the condition, and you get this resultant further breakdown of skin, pus formation, and so forth. Rosacea. How many people here have heard of rosacea? Yes. Red face? Yes. Yeah, many, many people have it. It's quite not uncommon, that's for sure. It's a common chronic facial disorder of middle-aged and older people. So you can see it here. So you get this hyperpigmentation, you get inflammation, you do get angiogenesis or the tissue. Now, I show this because anybody here ever heard of the actor called W.C. Fields? He was a cigar-smoking kind of a comedian, and he had this big bulbous nose as part of his routine. We used to think if you saw something like this, your first reaction would be is that they're an alcoholic. We used to think that that was the result of alcoholism. In fact, it's a result of actually a result of rosacea. That's what this has been treated. So this is A is when they came into the office, and B is when they've been treated. So we're starting to treat it quite well now. But yeah, people would get this, basically this rash affects the nose and starts breaking it down. You get these huge bulbous noses. So, it's a form of acne. It's differentiated by age, the presence of a large vascular component, and usually the absence of comedones, which are small, flesh-colored white or dark bumps that give skin a rough texture. So, we used to call it acne rosacea. That was its more common term. Now it just goes by rosacea. There is no known cause or factor that's been identified, so we don't know why. It is currently considered to be a condition with vascular and inflammatory components in the presence of an altered innate immune response. What does that mean? It's considered a condition with vascular and inflammatory components in the presence of an altered innate immune response. So it's so you're getting an altered inflammatory immune reaction to this area, which results in this condition happening. Clinically, the cheeks, the nose, and the chin have a persistent rosy appearance marked by reddened skin. You can have pustules, you possibly have papules, you can have burning or stinging, episodic flushing, and facial edema. Now, I had a girlfriend many years ago. She had this, and her specialist she went to told her a classic sign of the, what's the word I want? What can be a pretense to the disease, or what may suggest that you have a possibility of getting this, is if you're the type of person who gets the really flushed face when you drink wine or alcohol, you get this like huge kind of flush. Yeah. No, but she gets flushed when she drinks alcohol. That's a good question. I think it's a sensitivity. I don't think it's an allergy. It happens more in women than men. Men generally don't tend to get as flushed with alcohol as women do. The only thing we never talk about is women metabolize alcohol differently than men do. No, you actually, you can't handle alcohol as well as men can do. Yeah, and it's different. Yeah, it's so, you know.
That's not why I'm fine one moment and then I'm
right.
Drunk.
yeah. So that's why they say, you know, maybe a guy can drink a couple of beers and drive a car. A woman probably can only drink one beer and shouldn't drink a second one. You just metabolize it differently. It's not the same, right? So changes in body or environmental temperatures can cause it. UV radiation exposure. Even spicy foods can cause this to react. Okay. Can worsen over time, of course, with this redness hanging around, suddenly getting pimples. Okay, I can never pronounce this word right. Telangiectasis. You know when you get the blood vessels in the telangiectasis. I can never say that word. Okay. Yeah. Dilated. Yeah. See, you see these sometimes in certain lesions. People have these big red blood vessels. Like, that's what that is. That's a bit what this is too, actually. You can also get what's called nasal hypertrophy, which is rhinophyma. This can get so bad it will affect your eyes. So you can have ophthalmic disease, blepharitis, which is inflammation of the eyelids, keratitis, which is inflammation of the cornea of the eye. So this can actually work its way into the eye itself. Right? Yes. Yes. It could cause blindness if it was left to hang around. Seeing. Yeah. So when we look at medical management, of course, we're trying to deal with the inflammatory papules, pustules, and surrounding erythema through topicals and or systemic therapies. And some thought is now with these, that's what these pictures are, laser and other light-based therapies. So this is kind of an advertisement I got offline saying, this is the before, and then after laser treatment, this is after. Yes, that's a gentleman, actually. It is the same person. Yeah, before, no, down here. So this is before, and this is after laser. Yep. I don't know how long it lasts for. I'm not sure how often it would have to happen. I don't know if this is a condition that will qualify for getting it under OHIP. I don't know. I don't know that. The laser therapy for something like this, so whether or not, I don't know if it could be covered or not. I don't know if it's considered to be. Yeah. Anything that's not considered medical initially. If you can prove that it's like, for example, even having like a breast reduction, for example. It's causing back problems and all those sorts of things, then it qualifies to be covered by OHIP. If it's not, then it's considered to be cosmetic, and then you have to pay for yourself. Impetigo. How many people here know they've had impetigo? I guarantee you, all you guys have had impetigo. It's that contagious and that common with children. It's very much a child-born disease. You've had impetigo? You probably have, actually. Because of just the way the children are close to each other and play and those sorts of things. What's that? Yeah. It's crusty and actually falls off. No, this is so common, it's crazy. It's just, have you ever had like a bit of a wound that gets crusty on top and you just peel it off? You know, just peel it off? You ever had that where you get the exudate gets hardened? That's all this is hardened exudate that's leaking out of the wound and drying off in the. Possibly, yeah. It's highly contagious. It's a superficial skin infection. Commonly caused by staphylococci or streptococci bacteria. Most commonly found in infants between 2 to 6 years of age. And older adults, because again, long-term care, you're closer together because of its contagious aspect, it can. Most often occurs during hot, humid weather. And what predisposes this? Well, kids get it because they're close contact in school, in the social, economic, lower status of poverty, because they're living overcrowded in living quarters, poor skin hygiene, anemia, which is low. Iron, good. Malnutrition and minor skin trauma. You have a greater than normal chance of catching it. Sorry?
Daycare.
Yes, daycares for sure. Absolutely. Sandboxes, you name it, right? It can be spread by direct contact or environmental contamination. Often occurs in conditions where the skin is broken already, so such as pre-existing eczema, a herpes zoster, or mosquito bites. What you get these macules, these erythematous macules, flat spots, basically. And what happens, they develop into erosive papular lesions, that should be papular, or vesicle small blisters that become pustular. So you actually get these ventral pustules, and they will break and leak. So when you get this vesicle break, you get this classic honey-colored crust that is the result of the fluid coming out of the breaking down of the lesion and drying in the air and becoming crusty. Trust me, if you have little kids, at some point you'll likely be cleaning this up off your kids. Don't worry.
No, I'm not touching that.
No, you wear gloves. Itching is common. Scratching can spread the infection. This is the problem with very young children. They're not going to be able to control themselves when it's itchy. So what are they going to do? They're going to scratch the lesion, then they go in the sandbox and play with their friends, and everybody gets it. Yeah. It's also self-limiting. It will eventually just dry up and disappear. It's not a dangerous infection, but it's... You want to get rid of it, for sure. Usually the face and extremities, and you can usually, it'll end within 2 to 3 weeks without scarring. You can get fever, pain, and cellulitis, if it's present, there might be something else going on. So you can get a more serious infection, but it's likely not the impetigo that's caused that. It's something else that's going on that needs to be investigated. Antibiotics are commonly used in it. You guys want a break? Yep. See you guys around 5-2. It's like I did say previously that this does... Okay, here we go. You're doing this again. All right, so let's continue. So if we review the diseases we've done so far, I think I'll get in the habit of doing this just so everybody knows it. So we did atopic dermatitis. Do you? So you have atopic dermatitis we've covered, contact dermatitis we've covered, eczema and dermatitis we've covered, stasis dermatitis we've covered, and rosacea. Now we're going to do viral infections of the skin, okay? So the first is herpes. How many people here have heard of herpes? Oh, the more than cold sores. Yes. Yes, you can give genital herpes if you have oral herpes, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it has to be open and weeping. So when it's weeping, that's the virus that's actually within that fluid, and that's where you can pass. We'll talk a whole lot about that. Herpes comes from the Greek word to creep, to move slowly. This refers to the ability of the virus to become chronic, latent, and recurrent. What's that mean? Chronic means long-term. Latent means what? Yeah, it can hide in the bushes, right? It's there, but it's not showing any signs. And then recurrent, it can come back. The known herpes viruses are divided by genomic and biologic behavior into 8 types. Now, we're not going to get into all 8 types, but there are 8 types of herpes. Well, look at the box, though. No, just understand that there's, when we say herpes, there's more than one type of herpes. Yeah. They are morphologically similar, but the biologic and epidemiological features of each are slightly different. Generally, subclinical primary infections are most common than the symptomatic illness, and each type persists in a latent state for the rest of the life of the host. Okay, so if you have HPV, you have herpes for life. Even papillomavirus can be involved in herpes. If you have, so it's all about whether or not, no, it all depends, Kate, it all depends, Claire, it all depends on if you are exacerbated. So, like I said, it's the same as oral herpes. the lesion needs to be weeping the virus, yes, then you can pass it on. So females can have remissions and exacerbations. So obviously, you know, the recommendation by any physician to a female or male, more with females, if you're in an exacerbated acute state, please don't have intercourse or have sex, because you increase the risk of passing the disease on. When a woman is in remission, sex can be normal, having a child can be normal, those sorts of things, right? You could, yes, correct. Yes, it could, absolutely, yes. Yeah, cesarean. Cut you in the belly, cesarean section. What's that? Oh, that's not as bad as other things you can be born with. The worst thing I've ever watched was babies that are born to moms who are heroin addicts. The babies are addicted to heroin when they're born, and in their bassinet or whatever, they scream for days and days and days. They're withdrawing. Yeah. Terrible. Herpes simplex and varicella zoster remain latent in sensory ganglia, and when they activate, they produce lesions along the sensory nerve distribution shingles. And the shingles is important to us as massage therapists, because we need to recognize it to know whether or not we're seeing it. Yes, if the lesions are open and weeping. Okay? But ultimately what happens is, we're going to find out, anybody know what disease, do you guys know what disease this produces? Besides senil? Chickenpox. So if you've had chickenpox, this is in your body right now, and it can become shingles. No, you have to have the virus in you to get shingles. And you get the virus in you, your initial infection is usually chickenpox.
My mom always told me if I had chickenpox, I wouldn't get shingles.
Oh, no. It's the exact opposite. If you had shingles, you have a higher rate of probably having shingles when you get to be my age. Yes, because, no, but you will get shingles. So we're going to learn, you guys have taken you're taking neuro right now, right? You know where you guys have taken neuro so far, right? Do you know what a ganglia is? Yeah, that knob, okay? So when you have chickenpox and chickenpox is gone, that virus goes and hangs out there for the rest of your life. What's that? Yeah, the shingles. No. Right.
So why do I have to get it now?
You have to get the Shingrix, which is the shingles vaccine.
When I went to my whatever for clinic, they gave me the chickenpox one. They gave me the chickenpox one.
Interesting. I don't know why. If the host is immunocompromised and they get shingles, shingles can become a little more than just a rash. It can actually go and spread into lesions in the central nervous system and organs and make the individual very ill and possibly die from it. It's in the herpes family, yes. So this is what you would call a cold sore, which is herpes simplex. No, it's herpes simplex for our needs. Okay, so right here, that's herpes simplex. And then shingles, which comes from the varicella zoster, is this one right here.
My mom had that on her
face. Oh, I know people who've got it in their eyeball.
Ooh.
Oh, yes.
You can lose your eye.
You can.
Ooh.
Yes.
So I
had a
client where
he had it all over
their back.
Correct. Yep.
And they said that whoever didn't have chickenpox, I never had chickenpox, couldn't do their care. But if I had never had chickenpox, I'm not going to get shingles, right?
Yes. It's an active virus. You can.
If you're vaccinated, then you're protected. But
yeah. No, she said she's never had chicken pox, so they said she's fine because she won't get shingles. You just said you were told that if you didn't have chicken pox as a kid, you could take care of the patient because you wouldn't get anything from the shingles, correct?
Wrong.
So, right here, you see these fluid-filled, see these fluid-filled vesicles? In there right now in that fluid are live swimming viruses. Okay? So that's why if you have a shingles patient, you'll see the nurse is fully gloved, gowned, physician as well, who's palpating the structure, because that fluid is highly contagious. He, well, he may not have known whether or not it was shingles at the time. So, let's do simplex first. They're which? Oh, yeah. Oh, trust me. I worked in the hospital during SARS. I don't know if you have any idea. We're going to talk about it. SARS was, we're so lucky that it burned out fast because it would have been, its death rate was unbelievable. And I was worked in the hospital at the time. Doctors would scream at the front door people because they refused to wear gowns and gloves and masks.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it. Yeah. So, herpes simplex. There are two types, type 1 and type 2. Approximately 70% of Americans older than 14 years have HSV-1 cold sores. I got my first primary HSV-1 infection when I was about 35. I got gingivitis. I got a fever. We're going to learn about that. I didn't get cold sores. I got all this other stuff. And yet I've never had a cold sore since. Not yet. Weird, eh? I had the primary infection, so I somehow got this. So, HSV-2. So, HSV-1 is like, think of the mouth sore, right? 70% of people. HSV-2 is one of the most common sexually transmitted diseases in the world and is the principal cause of genital ulcers and genital herpes. And here's why. Ladies, can you see inside?
No.
Correct. If we get it as men, we go, oh, get to see that you got something going on there. Ladies may not necessarily know that they have an exacerbated lesion because it's inside. Will have normal sexual lifestyle and not recognize that the male, and you're not using a condom or anything, can pass, again, you've got leaking fluid from the lesion on the vaginal wall or part of the uterus, and it gets rubbed into the tissue of the male, and then, boom, they're infected. It can be, oh my, I just say I know somebody very close to me who has it, and it's extremely painful for them. Like, they know when they're in an exacerbation because it's so sore for them that there's nothing happening. Even going to the washroom is difficult, those sorts of things. Yeah. Yeah. In 2016, in the U.S., 47.8% of people had type 1 and 12% had type 2. 12% of how many people are in America? 20 million? Think of how many people that is. In 2016, basically, 50% had type 1, the type you get on your lip, and 12% had type 2 genital. Yeah, but here's the thing. This is why, this goes back to why you must have safe sex until you know what's happening, right? You know, people forget. AIDS really got people aware of safe sex practices, but there are other reasons why, and this is one of them, right? Yeah. But here's the thing. It's exactly what I said. 81% of initial cases go unrecognized. So they have an exacerbation, they don't know it, they don't go to the physician, and then all of a sudden they start having an active sexual life, and then you got a problem. There's an old saying we used to say with AIDS. The person you sleep with, you're sleeping with all their previous people that they slept with. Because Their potential for any sexually transmitted disease is quite high, right? Both type 1 and type 2 affect any visceral organ, mucocutaneous site, and HSV-1 can be transmitted to the genital area during oral sex. Okay? Douglas, what's his last name? Our first name, you know, the big actor. Michael Douglas. You know Michael Douglas, that's throat cancer, right? Yeah. How do you not know who Michael Douglas is?
I'm going to look him up right now.
Okay.
Him.
No. This one.
Yes.
Oh, no, I don't know.
Okay. I'm getting old, man. So, what happens here? You get intermittent asymptomatic shedding and the typical time of transmission immediately preceding the appearance of sores. So, in other words, people will engage in sex and then when free of sores, which results in asymptomatic transmission. So you can be asymptomatic, think everything's okay, and have intercourse, and then away it goes. You're infected.
So somebody has herpes, that could be a contraindication, right? Like I can't massage you.
No, like, you don't massage down there. You don't massage down there. No, that's shingles. We're not there yet. This is herpes.
Okay,
okay. So we see, I don't know if I have pictures here. So you can see, you know, the difference between them. So infants. Correct. Right. Well, you kind of could. If the lesion was out here on the lip and you're working in here, so long as you're wearing a glove and universal precautions, you should be able to do so, right? Even if it's open, I mean, there are times where procedures have to be done where a patient does have an open sore on the lip, right? But again, precautions are necessary, right? As far as that goes. Infants born in the womb with genital herpes can be infected with it via the birth canal, and it can also pass to other regions of the body through direct contact. So you can get it, as far as that goes. So no kissing or oral sex if you've got an active lesion on the lip, so forth. Obviously, no sexual practices whilst someone is in exacerbations, right? Those are the things. But I can tell you, this person that I know very intimately, she has herpes, but she has two children and was able to have two children and live a very normal life with herpes. No, without them getting it. Yep. Yep. Okay, so it's not an end of life sentence by any means. You just have to manage your life appropriately. So pathogenesis. Well, so when we compare these two, they are genetically and serologically different and produce different symptoms. Both can affect the oral mucocutaneous and genital areas. So inside, out of the mouth, the lip itself, that kind of stuff. And then, of course, genital herpes areas. Primary infections occur through a break in the mucous membranes of the mouth, throat, eye, or genitals, or through minor abrasions of the skin. What I didn't put in there, which I realize now is I don't even believe in the book, is also the anal area. So you can break the tissues of the anal area and have an exacerbated lesion, and that could cause it there as well. Correct, right? Like through anal sex, if you had an active lesion, you could pass it to that tissue as well. Initial infection, though, this is the hard part. Initial infection can be asymptomatic. You could be infected with this condition or with this virus and not even know you've got it, and continue to have an active lifestyle, sexual lifestyle, and just start passing it on all over the place, right? Local multiplication occurs with systemic infection and a long life latent infection with periodic reactivation. That was me. So my very first primary infection, I went to the doctor. I was sick. I had a fever of 102. My gums were all swelled up and red. I had terrible gingivitis. I felt like terrible. And I went to the doctor. At the time, I thought I had something really weird going on. I said, "What have I got this?" He's like, started laughing. He said, "No." He says, "You just got a primary herpes infection. In three days, you'll be back to normal." And sure enough, after 3 days, everything disappeared. I got a cold. I somehow got a primary infection. I didn't get a cold sore, but to this day, I have nasal problems all the time. You always hear me clearing my nose and everything. I believe, and nobody believes me, I think I have herpes infections up in my sinus. Any mucous membrane can be affected by herpes.
So what,
I have no idea. I could have been touching a baby and it touched my mouth or something. Like, who knows? Is one of those things. I just haven't had, where's wood? I have not had a reactivation since then.
I don't think that's real wood.
Wood chips.
While the virus entering the peripheral sensory nerves and migration along the axon, it avoids immune detection and response. So it has the ability, once you have that infection, to crawl up those nerves and get into those sensory ganglion, and the immune system doesn't see it and you don't have a reaction to it. So somewhere in my body, I have this virus hanging around in the sensory neuron somewhere, which means my potential for shingles is there. But, oh, I just realized I'm 65. You get the shots for free. I'm going for the shots because they're expensive. They're $200 a shot. Yeah. For Shingrix, yeah.
Is that why they gave me the chicken pox?
Maybe.
You only get it once?
Two. It's two shots now. I believe so, yeah. Yeah. But the nice thing is, you're less likely to get it at this age than I am. Okay. One of the things that can really kick it up and getting you into an exacerbation is physical or psychological stress. Quite often, you'll see patients who have got an active shingles going on, and they've been stressed out about something. There's been a death in the family or something along that line, and they end up with this shingles exacerbation. So let's do clinical manifestations of one first. Typically, HSV-1 affects the mouth and oral cavity, causing vesicles in the mouth, in the throat, and around the lips. So yes, you can get this infection all the way down your throat. So you can get the canker or you can get the lip sore, but you can also get it on the inside and you can also get it in the back of your throat.
Just the way it
exacerbates. Typically, the vesicles open to form moist ulcers. Systemic symptoms can accompany with fever, myalgias, and malaise, and they resolve anywhere from 3 days to 2 weeks. Primary infection, as I said, is also often asymptomatic. When you have recurrences, they tend to be milder, involve fewer lesions, are shorter in duration, and usually confined to the lips. And they're most commonly induced by stress, fever, sunlight, and infection. Now, if you've got someone, my father had chronic cold sores all the time. And now I know, with what I know, his immune system was very poor at the time. For some reason, he wasn't fighting it, and he just kept getting these cold sores over and over and over again. Obviously, his immune response was very, very low, and the virus was able to sort of take over. Okay? So here we can see the lesions here, another one here, and they can get quite extensive, and we can see it here in a very, very young child, and also into the mucosa of the roof of the mouth or the gum line there as well.
That
would be brutal. Yeah. Yeah. Now, what are the... For HSV-2, remember this is the STD, 2 is the STD, it causes vesicles to form on the mucosal and cutaneous surfaces of the genital area, okay? And lesions are usually painful, small, grouped, and fascicular with possible burning and itching. So they tend to be, you know, they're fluid-filled, they group together, they're quite large. Yes, correct. These vesicles eventually can blister, break, and weep after a few days, leaving ulcer-like sores that crust over and heal to 1 to 3 weeks. So you can have these lesions, they break, they weep, and then they crust over and take some time for them to disappear. Genital ulcers may occur in the genital area, cervix, buttocks, rectum, urethra, or bladder, causing vaginal and urethral discharge, dysuria, painful peeing, cervicitis, which is obviously inflammation of the cervix, proctitis, inflammation of the rectal area, and tender inguinal adenopathy. So you can actually get adenopathies. You guys know what adenopathies are? Swollen implants in the inguinal area. So you'll note that there are some hard nodules of the lymph nodes in the inguinal area.
If
you've got something going on, type 2, yes. Okay. Sorry?
Would that be a sign then?
I have had a patient one time who I palpated and I found nodules in the inguinal lymph chain, and I did send them to the physician because there was no associated infection or anything at all. So if I felt nodules here and asked the patient, how are you feeling? Well, in fact, I'm feeling like I've got a fever and all those sorts of things. That's a little bit different, but to have that sort of thing and there's no symptomology, then off to the doctor because I could possibly be cancer, like testicular cancer or something like that, right? So I sent him off. Dysuria, painful peeing. This is, right? This is pain. Urea, pee, urine. Occasionally systemic symptoms, you can get headaches, malaise, myalgias, which are, what? What's myalgia? Muscle pain. And fever. Genital reactivation can be associated with a prodrome, such as tingling or pain. Even in the lip with type 1, it's not unusual for a patient to say before the lesion appeared that it was really buzzing and tingly in the area where it came up. Yeah, does he feel a buzz before it comes? Yeah, she feels. Yeah, and she feels the buzz coming, and you know you're going to get one, right? Yeah. Prodrome. So it's something that happens prior to the disease showing itself.
No, the one above it.
Malaise? Basically fatigue. And myalgia is muscle pain. The first symptomatic episode that you have might be your primary infection. It may not be because it can be asymptomatic, but it could be your first one. It's just when you feel it. Known as a non-primary infection, patient may have been exposed to HSV-1, producing antibodies, but not developing symptoms until exposed to HSV-2 or vice versa. Do you understand that? Known as non-primary infections, this means that the patient may have been exposed to one or the other, not gotten ill from it, but produced antibodies. Remember the production of antibodies when you're exposed to, right? Right. Remember the memory cells, T cells, B cells, all that kind of stuff. And then if you get one of the other ones, so if you got an initial one and you get a two, you get a really significant inflammatory response to it because they're closely enough associated that the immune system will recognize it as a invader or whatever you want to call it. Okay. HSV can be responsible for other infections such as viral meningitis, and happens more commonly from two than it does from one. Meningitis means what? Inflammation of the meninges. Have you done that? And the spinal cord. You got it. The subarachnoid space. Let's get in there. Good. All this stuff's connected. Herpatic keratitis can occur, which is ulceration of the cornea. It's one of the most common causes for corneal blindness as a result of HSV-2 or 1. Onset is acute, accompanied by blurry vision. How do we manage it? First, it has to be tested. Is it type 1 or type 2? That's usually done with a swab. I think it's a swab, isn't it, usually? Yeah, they'll take the lesion and they'll take a swab and they'll just collect some of the fluid, one or the other, and then they put it in a medium. I don't know what the medium is. And then, what is it? Is it Lysol medium? And then look under the microscope and then they can determine which one it is. They could have. Yep. For HSV-2, we use acyclovir, femciclovir, and valacyclovir, and then medications do not eradicate the virus. They only lessen the symptoms of whatever's going on. Pain management, drop the lesions down, those sorts of things. But you get this, you've got it for life, either one of them. There's no known cure for it. So we can see here the genital version on the top. So we can see the lesions on the head of the penis here. On the foreskin, we can see the lesions here on the labia minora, on the external part. On this picture here, we can also see there are lesions in the perineal area here between the vaginal opening and the anus. Like they can go anywhere in there. What's that? Yes, and you can see that would be very, very painful, right? That is correct. Right, very much so. Right. That's just the shingles. That's showing shingles on the skin. Okay? Thank God there's doctors and nurses in there that can touch and deal with this stuff, right? The middle one has this one. So this is the vagina or the external genitalia of a female. And the reason this, you can see how the lesions go not just within the labia and the hood of the clitoris. You also have lesions that go out into the labia majora, into this area, and down into the perineal area. Like they can extensively cover a fair amount of the genital area. Remember, guys, this is no different than a heart or stomach. It's just that happens there. It is. It's very painful. I can tell you from the person I know, it's extremely painful. Okay, type 3. So that was 1 and 2. So that is your traditional cold sore, and your STD is 2, right? So 1 is your traditional cold sore orally. Type 2 is more your traditional genital STD. Type 3 is the varicella zoster virus, and this is known to cause chickenpox and shingles. Before the vaccine, the chickenpox vaccine, any given year, there were always between 3 to 4 million cases of chickenpox in the U.S. And I would think that's no difference to our numbers, just that we have less people. Yes. It prepares your immune. It's like any other vaccine. It stimulates your immune system to recognize the virus before it gets a foothold in you. No, I think with the vaccine, I think you can avoid getting chickenpox. Yeah, we'll get there. Vaccine started in 1996, and chickenpox incidences dropped by 90%.
I was born after that. Why didn't I?
So when I was a kid growing up, I don't know what it was like in India. If a kid had chickenpox, all the parents would bring the kids over and throw them all in a room together so they'd all get it. Yeah, exactly, because you wanted... Because my understanding was, and I don't know this for certain, but as an adult, if you get this, you're pretty sick, right? Compared to when a kid gets it, you're very, very ill.
Yeah. When you're a kid, don't you?
Yeah. No. You're irritated. You have a mild fever, and you're cranky, and whatever. Right. Adults is not a good thing to get this when you're an adult.
Wait, adults can still get.
Absolutely. One in three individuals will develop secondary reactivation of this, which results in herpes, zoster, or shingles. There are 1.2 million cases of shingles in the U.S. every year, and the risk starts to increase after the age of 50. To the point where I heard somewhere anecdotally, now at my age at 65, I think it's like one in three, pretty much you're going to get shingles at some point-ish. It's just that common enough. What's that? Yeah, I know the whole reason for the chickenpox vaccine was not for chickenpox. It was for shingles. Because it didn't want...
They were two different things. I'm so
confused. No, it's the same. It's the same virus. It's the same virus.
No, I know that.
Remember we talked about how the virus goes along to the ganglion?
Yeah.
Well, this does too. So you're a kid, you get the initial chickenpox... Because someone like my age, okay, there was no vaccine when I was growing up, so I don't want to have shingles, so I get the shingles shots now, and that will prevent this virus from exacerbating into shingles on my body.
So it's
maybe
the money grab.
No. Oh, trust me, if you've never seen anybody with shingles?
No, why they charge people for it before
they turn? Because it's new. Yeah. No. Yeah. The one thing with past class, you'll start to think you all have everything wrong with you.
Well, I know, that's what I feel like.
Yes, correct. So, pathogenesis. Now, as we know, it has the capacity to persist in the body and hangs out in the dorsal root ganglia next to the spinal cord following your initial chickenpox infection. So you get active chickenpox, which looks like that, right? That was me. I remember being like that. Those itch like freaking crazy. I think I got it when I was 5. I think I got chickenpox when I was about 5. So you initially get this, and then when it calms down and you think the disease is gone, the active exacerbation is gone, but the virus actually takes a little drive and hangs out here for the rest of your life. Okay? Just hangs out there. No, this one. Yeah. Varicella is acquired from contact with airborne droplets, coughing and sneezing, into the respiratory tract, or direct contact with vesicular fluid to mucous membranes or the eye. So, of course, a child like this, you can see the the pustule and stuff coming out of the eye here. You know, he scratches himself, his buddy comes over, they're touching, and it goes in the eye, or a finger touches the mouth, or in, away you go. Okay? The virus enters lymphoid tissue. It gets taken up by T cells where the virus, through a number of steps, invades the immune system. It spreads throughout the body through blood, occurring in 6 to 8 days before the appearance of skin lesions. So a child is infected with this before you start to see it. Okay? So this is why it spreads so nicely, because the child is infected, feeling okay, goes to school, plays in the playground, goes to daycare or whatever, and then 6 or 8 days later, all of a sudden, boop, 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 all these things start showing up, and away you go. Once the virus is in the skin, the vesicles are formed, and replication of the virus continues, but the virus is no longer in cells. It's in the tissues. It then moves retrograde from nerve endings to the regional ganglia. Do you know what retrograde means? It's going from the skin backwards, following the nerve, because sensory nerves, right, they start here and go back, so it starts traveling backwards toward the spinal column, going up the nerve. I'm surprised you haven't done that in neuro class. You haven't talked about retrograde yet? Okay. All right. So then what happens is cell-mediated immunity is eventually able to clear the virus from the body except at the dorsal root ganglia. So while the infection's going on, these few viruses sneak up into the dorsal root ganglia. The immune system doesn't see it, but it does see the active infection in the child. Immune system goes out, rids the body of the chickenpox infection. Everything calms down, but these few viruses are kind of sneakily hanging out secretively in the dorsal root ganglia. The mechanism for reactivation is unknown, but it's thought that a compromise to the immunity occurs. There's no longer a check on the virus. The infection occurs antegrade along the nerves, meaning retrograde had the infection initially go up the nerve to the spinal cord. Antegrade activation of shingles is the virus leaving the dorsal root ganglia and traveling down the nerve back to the skin that nerve is responsible for. So when we look here, ultimately what's happening is, have you guys taken dermatomes yet in assessment? Yes. So because it's traveling down the sensory, I'll talk a little bit about it. No, but you've seen the map where you have, right? So what happens is when the virus comes down the nerve, it follows its dermatome. So if it can be distinct enough, the physician can look at this and go, where are we here? That would be about T12, I think. But so they'd say, oh, that's a T12 nerve root. It's following the perfect pattern of the T12 nerve dermatome. Yeah, that can be a cranial nerve. Cranial nerves can obviously, no, this would be the trigeminal nerve, so this would be a cranial nerve. So they can hang out in cranial nerves and affect. Hence the reason why patients can get it in their eyes, in their nose, side of the face, and so forth, depending on which nerve it's talking about. Nerves exhibit severe inflammation. You also have associated hemorrhagic necrosis of the nerve cells, which causes a severe pain of shingles. So you actually have nerve cells dying with a significant amount of inflammation. Patients have told me even the weight of a single cotton sheet is too much. It hurts too badly. That's what she said, yeah. It's terribly painful. Even breathing on it is too much. It's very, very painful. The new skin lesions produce vesicles filled with high titers of infectious virus. This is really important to understand. These vesicles are filled with massive amounts of infectious virus. So if you break those, if it's on the patient, they'll go right back in and away they'll go. But if it gets on you, you can pass it to yourself as well. These fluid-filled vesicles, that fluid is chock full of virus.
If it pops on their skin,
I think you head right back in on the patient, right? If they were to touch it and touch themselves again, I think they'd reintroduce the virus back in, right? Yeah. No. Yes. Incubation period is 14 to 16 days from exposure with a range of 10 to 21. Here's the key. You're massaging them. They say that they have a bit of a rash. Not really looking like shingles, but when it starts to look like shingles, 2 days before that, they were already shingles and they were infected, and you may have rubbed them. you could possibly. So this is why I'm going to put it this way. That's why when you treat somebody, your head needs to be in the game, not talking about your shopping list and what your kids are doing that day and all that stuff. Because it's really hard to get people to understand just how focused you need to be, because you have to be thinking about all these things all the time. Is there a bad mole on their skin, which might suggest skin cancer? Is there a lesion there if you're in long-term care? Is this the initial breaking down of skin that will eventually become a pressure ulcer? Is it a rash that might eventually here become shingles? Like, there's so much you need to think about when you're treating somebody, rather than just like, going golfing tomorrow and whatever, right? Drives me bonkers. This is our responsibility. You know, this is why we learn this stuff, because we need to be very aware of it. Remember I showed you those lovely nails with the fungus? Do you remember that?
So why don't, like, nurses have to learn?
Nurses have to learn all this stuff. No, because they won't. We need neuro because we need to see if there's weakness and function, right? But as far as something like this, nurses definitely would need to know all about this and how to treat a patient like this to prevent infection and all that kind of stuff. Absolutely she would. Oh, yes. So how does type 3 show? It either shows as chickenpox or shingles, depending on where you are in their cycle, right? A child's going to be chickenpox. You might see an adult with shingles. The primary infection, the very first infection they get, is symptomatic, whereas in type 1 and type 2, it can be asymptomatic, right? Okay. Which means you can get a type 1 or type 2 herpes infection, genital or mouth, and not show any symptoms initially, right? And then later on you might, later. With this, when you get it, you show it. I always wouldn't go near it.
Okay, so just don't.
I wouldn't go anywhere near it. I would ask questions about painful. If they said, "Oh yeah, what am I to tell you about that? It hurts so goddamn much," I'd be like, "Oh yeah, they do. Absolutely, they do. Yeah. Why do you think we're telling you all this stuff? It's for a reason, right? It's for a reason, right? And this is why, you know. And you said it, and I'm hearing it in semester one. Why do we need to know all this stuff for freaking massage? This is our responsibility."
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Second episodes of chicken pox are uncommon unless a child is under one when they get chicken pox. I don't know why that is. I guess your immune system isn't enough to mount a response, eh? It says a second bout of chicken pox is rare unless the child has had chicken pox before the age of one. So I'm assuming it's because their immune system isn't prepared to create enough T cells and B cells yet, right? Yeah. Okay. Now, if an adult gets a primary chickenpox infection, you can have a prodrome of headache, photophobia, and malaise, and children will have the rash. So, here's your terminology. I wonder why I teach you all this stuff. The rash, when you get your chickenpox, the rash is vesicles on a red base that start as macules, quickly progress to papules, then to pustules, and then they crust. Yeah. Papules are pimples, right? Pustules are pimples full of pus. Then they break open, then they crust. Flat raises. Yeah. Correct. Yes. These usually appear on the scalp, move to the trunk, and then to the extremities. I always thought it was trunk first. I always thought they got trunk before extremities, not head. But yeah, usually, right? Completely around. Chicken pox does not have a rash that follows dermatomal patterns. That's the key thing to remember. Chicken pox has a rash that follows no particular pattern other than it goes everywhere. Shingles follows the dermatome. So if you go back home tonight or this weekend, you're studying and you look at your dermatomal map from assessments class, you know, C1, you know, see everything wraps around and down and twists. Whatever level is affected by the chickenpox virus or the varicella virus, the shingles will follow that dermatoma pattern. And you won't see the rash on either side or anywhere else. Okay? Yeah. The other thing that's very important to differentiate the two, shingles in adults have these lesions that erupt unilaterally, not bilaterally. So chickenpox, it's bilateral, the rash can both sides, where shingles tends to be one side only, not the other side. You can on occasion get both. No, it follows the dermatome. Follows the dermatome usually just on one side, wherever that dermatome is. Okay. Pain and itching are common when contracted during the first or second trimester. It carries a low risk of congenital malformations. It's low, but still has to be thought of. Shingles can lead to post-herpetic neuralgia, defined as pain lasting 90 days after onset that can continue for months to years. There's a 10 to 15% risk that you can carry that pain after the lesions have gone for 10 to 15 years. Hence the reason, get the freaking vaccine, because you could be left painful for the rest of your life. Yes. Herpes zosters can involve the cranial nerves, especially the trigeminal and genticular ganglia, or the ocular motor nerves. The geniculate is a vesicular formation in the external auditory canal, ipsilateral facial palsy, and ear pain. If it's a trigeminal, you get ophthalmicus, causes eye pain with corneal and scleral damage with loss of vision. It's a medical emergency. My office mate upstairs 4 years ago, she had it. She had her sclera were affected, but her husband is an emergency doctor, and they caught it within 72 hours, and he gave her the shot, whatever the, you know, the white of the eye actually had lesions on it. No, it's a special shingles shot now that if you can get it within the 72-hour window after first onset of symptomology, it cuts the issue in half. Maybe. I can't remember what it was. It was something. Maybe. It's where it crawled back to hang out since you had your chicken pox.
Oh, so
whatever ganglion it hangs out in, that's where your dermatoma pattern is going
to
be. That's right.
So do you have to put the shot into...
No, it just goes into the... No. Yeah. How do we manage it? Then we'll go. Diagnosis is made on clinical symptoms. With the vaccine, atypical cases has increased. Treatment for chickenpox is not curative, of course, because we can't get rid of it. Yep. Antiviral medications are used for shingles over 50. This is before Shingrix was really popular now. Individuals who develop new lesions more than 72 hours after the first lesions should start antiviral therapy. So you can, on occasion, you can get someone who'll have one and then another dermatoma pop up. Okay. Unvaccinated individuals who contract chickenpox can be vaccinated up to 3 days post-exposure. The vaccine is recommended for children 12 months or older with a second dose between 4 and 6 years. And then, as I said here, shingles vaccine is now available 50 years and older. It's 90% effective to prevent you getting shingles.
Give it to me right now.
So here you go. This is what it looks pretty innocent, doesn't it? I mean, no, it's a bad rash, but it's not, you just say it got a rash. Oh, there's lots of rashes that can be like this. Lots of rashes are like that. I know. Yep. So make sure you're, I know. Okay, guys, we're done. Yeah, trust me, I've seen... in the hospital setting, the patient will come in.